He would jump so high, jump so high. And then he'd lightly...
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We could use Sammy Davis under us for the entire show, but we won't do that today. We're here with Adar Ayira, project manager for More in the Middle campaign for Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of fusion partnerships, and Del Colbert, who is professor of law at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law and one of the folks who's been pushing the whole idea of pretrial rights in our city, state, and nation, and world, really. And good to have you both with us here in the studio.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Good morning.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Log on to my Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So I said I would start this way because I was really coming in this morning. I switch between stations all the time when I'm driving, keeping my eyes on the road, but switch between stations. Between Morgan and I wanted to hear some whammo over and what's going on with the morning edition sometimes. I listen in. And there was it was a report. They interviewed Cokie Roberts and the woman who is a reporter for the South about the fact that Mary Landrieu lost the election in Louisiana by this huge, huge number, like 12-15% of the vote. I can't figure out what it was, but huge number she lost the election. He didn't even bother to show up for the last week of the election because he knew he was going to just take it. So at any rate, the theme of the conversation was that now the Carolinas and below, every person representing the South in Congress and the Senate who is not African-American will be a Republican. And they talked about the history of America and the Emancipation Proclamation and why black folks became Republicans and why black folks became Democrats and what Lyndon Baines Johnson said when he passed the Civil Rights Law that we're going to lose the South for a generation. And their comment was, well, we lost the South a generation later. And in the entire conversation, never did I hear the word racism or race as a factor, or that there is something about the connections between the rise of black power, political power in Reconstruction, and the rise of black political power post-Civil Rights era, and the racism that ensued to build the Republican Party of the South afterwards, and they were actually the Dixiecrats before. None of that came out. None of the analysis. So it just shocked me hearing the premier public news media not giving that kind of thorough analysis, but just giving this kind of surface political analysis of what's going on in our country. Are you shocked, Adar?
Not at all.
You're not shocked.
Not at all. We over the past couple of years, and I would chart this to President Obama's first election in 2008, it is becoming increasingly unpopular now to mention racism in any form. And to mention that, you open yourself up to charges of, in fact, being racist or being divisive just by mentioning that there is a racial problem in this country. I think that it is a trend that we are going to see more and more of, because now the conversation is being stifled on all levels. And media, which is the lifeblood of communication and culture in this country, is a leading part of that. So I was not shocked at all.
And I think of, go ahead, please.
No, was I shocked, Mark. And there's very little that shocks me these days, because I look forward to the day when the white community will not grow silent as we talk about the current badges and incidents of slavery. And you mentioned in your opening that this is the anniversary of the 13th Amendment. And the 13th Amendment did more than simply abolish slavery. It eliminated the badges and incidents of slavery. And one of the primary badges was the presumed inferiority of people of African ancestry. The 13th Amendment was intended to eliminate, abolish, root and branch, all of the indicia of inferiority. And as we look at the violence that's taking place across this nation and the legal system's inability to address unjustified police killings of African Americans and Latino Americans, that goes to the very heart of what the 13th Amendment was intended to do, which was to protect the life and liberty of people who, prior to the 13th Amendment, had no legal protections at all.
I I mean, and that was the heart of Reconstruction. It was supposed to be the heart of Reconstruction. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And I teach a course on the 13th Amendment at Maryland Law School and try to bring in all of the relevant today, present vestiges of yesteryear's badges of slavery to try to show connections between what's happening today and what has previously happened. And I have to say that while my students are quite interested in learning history, it takes a while for the grown-ups to actually understand the importance of history in trying to explain what's happening in today's criminal justice system.
And let me add on to that. It's not just about the period of enslavement. And I think that a lot of people in the country, we get stuck there and say, oh, but we've not had enslavement in generations. Professor Ted Shaw gives this great lecture about how 91% of this country has been one of legal racialized barriers. And when we think about it from that way, Mark, 91% of this country, of the history of this country, has been actively engaged, legally engaged in anti-black concepts and philosophical perspective, along with life's chances and choices. That is a much different spin in terms of our trajectory of equality than just talking about enslavement. And we need to focus on the fact that we're talking 91% of the history of this country. We have had legal racialized barriers.
And what Adara mentions, Mark, is such an important issue when we start talking about what's taking place in Ferguson and Brooklyn and Staten Island and North Carolina,
Cleveland,
et cetera.
Baltimore.
Because the crisis that we face now as a lawyer, as a law professor, the crisis that I see in our justice system is an inability of bringing offenders to justice who kill or who injure citizens, and particularly citizens from the African American and Latino American communities.
I want to kind of let that segue into the piece I wanted to ask you about, Doug, but let me go to the phones first at 410-319-8888. Join us here with your thoughts. Chris in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Chris.
Forgive me for not having your guest names because I came in.
Doug Colbert and Adara Ayira.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
I just have to say that I patently disagree with the description of the 13th Amendment. I think the 13th Amendment, it clearly states, except where the party shall have been duly convicted. So it went from a socially accepted practice to a legally accepted practice by way of the amendment. It took slave codes to black codes. That was the beginning step of what we today call the prison industrial complex. I think that slavery has been continued, and it's clearly outlined in the amendment. So the popular way of describing it as abolishing slavery, et cetera, I think that's so wrong, and I think that's one of the reasons that we're in the situation that we're in today. It's strictly through the 13th Amendment. You have collateral consequences. You have all of these legal ramifications of even accepting a plea that are triggered by that amendment, and it makes everything that's done to these communities across the country, it made it legal by way of the 13th Amendment. If the amendment actually abolished slavery, they would not have put that provision in there for it to be legal in any fashion. I don't understand this description of it still in 2014 in a non-analytic way to describe it as abolishing slavery.
Okay.
Clearly, it is an exception.
Let me let Doug kind of respond to what you were saying. Doug,
yeah, I would love to have a much longer conversation with you because for many years I've reviewed the history, the intention behind the 13th Amendment. It's very clear that for people who are not incarcerated, the 13th Amendment was intended to abolish all of the indicia of slavery, everything that kept the African community to be regarded as an inferior people was supposed to have been changed fundamentally from the 13th Amendment. And so you can look at every freedom right that is guaranteed by the 13th Amendment and ask yourself whether today's issues are directly tied to what the 13th Amendment originally intended. I'm not talking about the people who are convicted and who are incarcerated. I'm talking about the free population that constantly faces so many areas of racial discrimination today.
Let me, and I think that we might want to come back to that and have a conversation about these amendments and what they really did in the whole piece of the Constitution, which I'm really fascinated by when the abolitionists, some abolitionists, William Lloyd Garrison and others, said we should ignore the Constitution because it's a racist document and not pay any attention to it at all and abolish it. And really have this a good larger conversation to have. And I think what we'll do is talk to Doug after the show and let you all know sometime after the first of the year that we can kind of wrestle with that. As a program, and my producers hear me promise one more thing, so we'll make sure we put that on our agenda to get that conversation started. Let me turn to you, Doctor, before we go to Clarence and Michael, our next two callers up. I wanted to really kind of lay out for our listeners right here why it's so difficult to indict, let alone convict, police officers when they do commit murder. I think when I saw one stat I read in the article, it was in the New York Times that we talked about earlier today, was 41 officers have been charged and over 2,600 were called justifiable homicides. 2,600 justifiable homicides.
Well, Mark, to say it as directly as possible, local prosecutors have shown an inability, an incapability of bringing police officers to justice who have killed without justification. And that has a lot to do with the relationship between the local prosecutor and the police department. They work hand in glove. I mean, they rely on each other. The police officers generally will make the cases for the local prosecutor. So when a police officer is accused of the unlawful use of force that results in the killing of a citizen, it's almost predictable that there will not be a criminal charge that follows that situation. What you need in those situations is either an independent prosecutor from the state who does not have ties to the local police or a federal prosecution. Grand juries are a vestige of 13th century England.
Yeah, why do we have them?
Well, we have them. They can be used in two ways. They can be used as a shield to protect individuals or as a sword that helps the prosecution, the government, the king, be able to prosecute those whom they want to prosecute. And so the problem with the grand jury, among other issues, is the secrecy that takes place. The door is closed. No one can see or hear or evaluate what's taking place inside the grand jury room. That makes it very easy, by the way, for prosecutors to indict people, to charge people, because there's only one lawyer in the room, and that's the prosecutor. The grand jury relies on the prosecutor for all of the legal information and takes cues from the prosecutor for when the prosecutor wants an indictment or does not want an indictment.
So in some way, so it's interesting. One of the things you said, though, is that the grand juries are vestiges of medieval law that was adopted by America and Western society out of medieval law that have nothing to do with the battles around the issue of democracy and law.
No, I mean, what it tells us is that we don't even know who are the people serving on grand jurors, how they're selected. We have seen blue ribbon panels where the people selected have direct ties to the power establishment. And so when people are looking at what happens in the grand jury, there are so many ways in which the process itself guarantees the result. If the prosecutor, and Greg Bernstein mentioned this in an op-ed article that he wrote in The Sun on Saturday, where the prosecutor wants to ask the grand jury not to return an indictment, there are so many ways in which prosecutors can present a weak case against the defendant. That doesn't usually happen, by the way.
Right, right.
It happens, though, when police officers become the potential defendant.
So I do want to get back to the phones here, Dar, but let me turn to you for a moment, and we'll go right to Milton in Edgewood and then to Clarence and Michael. you know, many people are saying, and maybe that's not what you want to talk about, you can go wherever you like, but many people, the arguments we've been having in this program are built around the policemen wearing video cameras, let's say. And I've been saying from the beginning, I think it's, sure, wear video cameras, it's fine. I'm not opposed to it at all. But that's not the answer to the problem. The question of independent prosecutors or of civilian review boards with the teeth to hire and fire and control, civilian control of the police, I mean, those are the issues, it seems, that should be bubbling up from our democracy, not just the notion of video cameras.
Yeah, you know what? In our society, in any conversation about race or racializations, we tend to dismiss, to deny, or to deflect. And when we have these grand juries, one thing that we have seen in these cases is that the grand jury has been used to uphold an existing system which benefits whites and do not benefit people of color legally. If we had police body cameras, if they were wearing them, good. I mean, like you, I'm not opposed. But offering that takes discussion away. It deflects discussion from the deeper institutional issues of bias, of implicit bias, of looking at people of color as thugs and criminals, regardless of whether they're victims, whether they're bystanders, anything. There, it takes and deflects away from how people see young black men and black women walking down the street. That's what we need to talk about, and we're not having that conversation.
And I think we have to get, should we go to break and take one caller in first? Can we take a caller? No, go to break? She's saying no, we go to break. So, Milton, we're going to come right back to your call after this break. And I think part of the question we have to discuss is then the answer in some ways, the answer is a political answer in terms of what has to happen to change the things in our society and how we get there. We are going to break here one of my favorites. Tom Waits. All the World is Green is what he's singing right now. He's a great singer, songwriter, composer, and actor. He was born on this day in 1949. Happy birthday, Tom Waits. We'll be right back.
Have a better life. Breathe you all the wild blue sky. Men do foolish things. You turn kings into
mind games. We do play a lot of mind games in this country. I'm Mark Steiner. That's Mind Games by the great John Lennon, who on this day was shot and killed in front of his home in New York City by Mark Chapman. John Lennon died today, and we play his mind games. And we do play mind games. Adara Yura is with us. Adara, of course, is project manager of More in the Middle Campaign for Associated Black Charities and facilitator and analyst at the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of Fusion Partnerships. And Doug Colbert, professor of law at the University of Maryland School of Law, and you at 410-319-8888. Let me go to Milton in Edgewood. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks, Mark, and good morning to you and your guests.
Good morning, Milton.
As you were going through the initial This Day in History,
yeah.
I missed the name of the guy who coined the name African-American.
Afro-American.
Okay, I'm sorry, Afro-American is what I was trying to say, yeah. Well, if you can tell me his name, and I have a comment on that.
His name is Timothy Thomas Fortune.
Fortune,
yes.
Okay, Timothy Thomas Fortune. I'll write that down. I'm always, like a lot of people, interested in the origins of things, which has to do with my comment also. Somewhere a while back, I don't remember when, but I thought of something that was, to me, interesting, intriguing, or whatever that sort of thing is. And it has to do with the origin of us, period. African-American, or Afro-American. I thought about it because I'm one of the people, you know, black guys that don't really have a problem using the N-word in just general conversation, in gist or jest, I think. Some folks are not comfortable with it, and I'm not trying to project that particularly. Mm-hmm. But because I tend to do that, one of my friends, Caucasian friends, always comments Afro-American when she hears me say that. And I said, you know what? What makes you think when I use that word that it, you know, has to do with, you know, Afro-American? I said, because, you know, what it boils down to, the way I understand it, the Garden of Eden was in Africa. So if all of us, you know, come from the Garden of Eden, as far as Christians believe, you know, Adam and Eve, then that means we are all, those of us who are Americans, Afro-Americans or African-Americans, because we come from the Garden of Eden. So even if you're white, you're black, or, you know, whatever, if you are an American,
okay,
you are Afro-American.
So let me let the panelists kind of think what they have to say. Adar? All right, go ahead, Adar. Whoever, go ahead.
The term African-American has a very distinct history, and that history has to do with the Ma'afa, with the theft, with the enslavement, with the generations of Jim Crow and anti-blackness, that people who are classified as African-American in this country have had to deal. That is part of their history, our history. So technically, biologically, maybe what the caller is saying is correct. But in terms of the read on our history, it is not correct.
And I think that we dehumanize people's right to life, to liberty, whenever we use references that historically have carried so much meaning in terms of the violence that has been demonstrated against particular groups, and in this case, the African American community. So I think language is extremely important. I think it shows a great deal of respect for history and for people's freedom rights.
Let me go back to the phones here, but you say we have that clip ready? I just want to leave this clip for us. This is another clip. Actually, this is a clip from National Public Radio that I gleaned last night and looking at some articles. It's just 25 seconds long. But it is between Eric Garner's stepfather, Benjamin Carr, and a young man in the streets protesting in his community. It's a very powerful piece. It says a lot about capturing the pain of the reality. I want you all just to hear this just for a moment.
I was right there. I was right there. I was there, Mr. Gardner.
Okay.
Every step of the way,
right,
I have pictures, everything.
Come on in.
And you know,
let's
it's
keep
just
the
gotten.
Peace.
I was doing
let's
everything
peace,
peacefully,
let's
but peace. It's gotten to the point where
you gotta keep the peace.
It's wrong.
I know.
We all are hurt.
It's like, where are we headed for? What's the future for me? What's the future for me? You know what I'm saying? For my child, for my son. What is his future?
I heard this piece last night as I was thinking about this morning's program and doing some research after I got home, and it just really hit me so deep because you can feel the pain.
You do feel the pain, Mark, and the biggest pain is not even the personal one that the father would feel for the loss of the son, but it's the distrust that is so prevalent in the communities that are most affected by police violence. And so the importance of a criminal prosecution and a successful one in the appropriate case where police use force unlawfully becomes more and more important. Every time we read of a situation like Eric Garner, who was strangled to death from an illegal, unconstitutional police procedure, and a grand jury decides not to even charge, not to even bring the case to a public trial, more suspicion, more distrust, more feeling that the legal system is not there to protect us, our children, our neighbors' children. And that's why we have such a tragedy here. That's why we cannot and should not let the local system proceed without taking some very strong measures and recognition that the local justice system has failed. And that's a very important truth, but it's a very difficult one for officials to accept and to understand that the only way that you regain trust is to open the system so that we can hear the witnesses, see the witnesses. It should not be a grand jury proceeding. These hearings should be taking place in a public courtroom where the community can be present, where the police have used justified force. That will be easier to understand. The many good police officers who do not engage in unlawful conduct can also take a great deal of solace in understanding that they will not be prosecuted either.
You know, what that clip, and maybe it's because in my communities, with my family, my friends, my cousins, my world, what that man was saying, that is how we feel. These are the conversations that take place around our dinner tables, around our breakfast tables, and particularly with our young people. What really struck me about that clip was Eric Garner's stepfather and an unidentified female voice saying, okay, but we need to keep the peace. And that historically has always been the narrative when people are talking to African descendants, African Americans, Black people who have had so much violence inflicted in our communities, that if we do not keep the peace, then somehow we have brought this on ourselves and we are at fault. There is never the outcry to any public officials, any of those charged with protecting us. There's never a call for them to keep the peace and to stop the violence.
I'm going to go back to the phones here because many people are calling. I'm going to get some people in this conversation. And Lawrence Brown tweeted in, how do we get this embedded in the curriculum of our K-12 education system? I think there is a process of education that has to go on. One of the things that I say this over again, I'm going to say it again, is that I am heartened by is when I see the demonstrations taking place around the United States of America. My producer sent me a piece that was out of Salisbury, Maryland over the last day, where Salisbury students and Baltimore people came down to march with Salisbury residents against police brutality in their own community and around what happened to Eric Garner, what happened to Michael Brown. And you look at the pictures that came out of Philadelphia and Chicago and L.A. and New York City, and looking at those photos last night, this is a photo of America. This is a photo of white, black, brown people, men and women together standing in ways I've not seen since 1963 in terms of people standing together in that way. And I think that there is a shift afoot in America that I think is very important for people to take a hold of that's happening here right now.
And that's the process that's going to be required if change is going to come in these situations, Mark. It's going to require black, brown, white, and Asian, and people holding hands and marching, protesting, calling for the justice system to work the way it's supposed to work, the way that we want it to work. And unless we have that, I'm afraid that we're just going to continue to see more of the same.
Adar?
You know, I think that it is great that so many people of different races, different ethnicities are out on this one issue. My concern is that it's not about just this one issue. It is about our institutions. It is about the very structure. And are these people going to be there for that?
And see, I'll push back a little bit on this, because mm-hmm. I think that's part of the kind of thing that I think that, because what I see was happening with people around the country, that's exactly what's happening. This is not just about Eric Garner. This is not just about Michael Brown. This is about people perceiving together there's an injustice in America that has to end. And that's what people are coming together around.
But
you look at the signs they carry. You look at what people are willing to do to go to jail to stop this. This is something different is happening here right now.
And Mark, what I'm saying is that they're willing to do that, but this is focused on the criminal justice system. I'm talking about bigger than that. I'm talking about the basic systems and structures of inequity. So it does go to housing. It does go to who is getting called back for jobs. It goes to everything.
There's no question.
It goes to the racial disparities in wealth. And what I'm saying is that I hope that this is a movement that addresses our broader racialized institutional and structural issues that promote and maintain those inequalities, as opposed to it being just this one note criminal justice.
But nobody knows where movements will go. when they start and erupt and what ends them. But I'm also taken apart by the studies that have been done, the polling that's been done in America that shows a change in the heart among so many people in this country questioning racism, the depth of it, questioning brutality. I've never seen this before in the history of the United States of America, ever.
And well,
ever. When we were in the Civil Rights Movement in the 60s, we were a teeny minority of people in America that believed that things could change, teenier even in the days of abolition. I've never in the history of this country seen this many people crossing racial lines in this deep way to make a statement.
Well, I say from your lips to God's ears, because it is going to take everybody to change the power imbalance in this country.
Everybody.
And it also is going to take a great deal to change the police culture. I mean, let's recognize that there is a culture of silence, that there are too many police officers and too many officials who know what's taking place, but they are terrified to speak against what is occurring. And so there's a big battle here that needs to be waged, and it's not limited to criminal justice. Many people know the truth, and it's important for the truth to be told in a multiracial way.
And that's a political change. That takes a political movement to change that part of America.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. And a cultural one. And a cultural one. Mm-hmm. Because there are so many studies now, Mark and Doug, that show that the cultural messages that we receive about race rewire our brains to think in a certain way.
Right.
And part of what we're seeing in policing, i.e. the police protecting some communities from other communities, that is part of what we see. Part of what we see is the outcome of that rewiring from the cultural messages that we receive every single day.
Let me open the phone here again and read another tweet. Lawrence also tweeted in just now. If racism and white supremacy aren't discussed in our schools, then whites will never be able to confront it at the beginning. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Steiner. The only argument I would, you know, present to your guest, the gentleman, is his use of the word inability. I kind of take my cues in from Chris Hodges, The Power of the Powerless. It was one of his books I read where he said this is a very effective control mechanism. And I would take a play off of this. In the absence of state law, federal law reigns supreme. Well, in the absence of clearly defined regulations where it says that if you shoot an unarmed civilian under these circumstances and so forth, then it becomes discretionary to a grand jury. So that, you know, this is, by my mind, with forethought, as the, you know, I related to Chris Hodges' book, one of them. You know, that's in place.
Oh, Chris Hedges, you mean? Chris Hedges.
Yes, Chris Hedges.
Hedges, right.
That's in place with forethought. So I would not use the word inability, you know. And one other thing, Mr. Steiner, in my life, I've never been more afraid than this particular time.
Afraid, you said?
Afraid or quasi-paranoid.
Right.
Because I don't think that most of the people that aren't out there protesting and up in an uproar about what's happening realize that this police brutality is not limited to black folks and people of color.
No, it's not.
I don't think so.
Well, you saw that the grand jury in Frederick County did not indict the officers who killed the young man with Down syndrome, Michael mm-hmm. Slaner, who was white, and mm-hmm. who died in the same way that Tyrone West did, the way he was being held down and restrained, died for the same reasons. And they were not indicted for that murder as well.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking the call, Mr.
Always Stein. Good to hear from you. Let me get another caller in here. We'll come back to our panel. 410-319-8888-D, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, D. Welcome.
Hi. And this is just my opinion, because I think we're going to continue to revisit these issues over and over again for generations if we do not address it from the very foundation of the Constitution. And because written in the Constitution, the foundation of the United States, it says that blacks are less than 3/5 of a human being. They did not judge you on a standard of a human issue. So keeping that in mind, everything that we have done after that has been an amendment or an adjustment, but the very foundation of this country says that blacks are three-fifths of a human being. So everything we do, education, religious, political, believe it or not, in my opinion, is judged based on the fact that you are judged less than a human being from the Constitution. And we always quote, well, the Constitution says, the Constitution says, well, the Constitution says that blacks are three-fifths of a human being. We're wasting time.
Now, is that still part of the Constitution?
Well, it was that was amended with the 13th
Amendment
and,
taken out
and by Supreme Court law. But I think that what the caller is saying is that we still live today with the vestiges of the past.
Yes, absolutely.
And
it's
not as though we can just wish this away in the minds and souls of people. And that's, I think, the point that Lawrence Brown was raising. We need to be educating the younger generation. That's our hope, that we can bring a sense of history and a sense of correcting the injustices to make sure that they don't continue to happen. But that's a very big step to bring education to K through 12. And then in college and in graduate schools, we're not doing that very well now. And that would be a major reform.
I think that that would be a major reform, too. And in fact, there are movements underfoot to even rewrite history books. So to talk about the period of enslavement differently, as if it were not that bad. And what the caller said about African Americans being subhuman in the national narrative of America, I think was really played out when you looked at some of the interview from Darren Wilson, when he was describing Mike Brown as this demon coming toward him. And there was one point where he said it. And it is so easy to inflict violence on people when you really do not see them as total human beings. And the young man, Tamir Rice, 12 years old, who was killed by police,
young boy, when
the policeman was interviewed, the policeman said, oh, I thought he was 20.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there have been studies done that shows that when it comes to race, that white people see African-Americans as being at least 10 years older than their actual age. So when you look at the implications of that, when you look at 6-year-olds and 9-year-olds being arrested because police think that they are 16 and 19, that can only happen when you really are not connecting with the humanity of human beings.
But the message is going to resonate for the jury or the grand jury that's predominantly white, because they too have a fear of the oversized black male. And so the race matters tremendously in who gets selected to serve on grand juries and on trial juries.
Let me go back to the phones here. And my friend Lawrence Brown retweeted in again. It certainly is in the culture. That's the insidious nature of implicit racial bias. It is unconscious. Hey, Lawrence, if you're on campus, just come on over and come to the studio. Always good to have you in here. 410-319-8888. Let me open the phones here again. And on the way to the phones, very quickly, just say that to what Adar was saying, that I think there's this new scholarship in America that is taking hold, and it has not taken hold in our history books and the way we teach our children, but a new understanding of enslavement, a new understanding of what slavery meant to the building of Western capitalism and the wealth in this country. Even though it was known by some folks, most people didn't have an understanding of that or the deep connection. That's what's not being taught. That's the root of it that is not inside this system. We're re-understanding our history, and I think that's part of the...
But Mark, also what I'm saying is that there is a movement to put in the history books that enslavement was not really that bad. That's what I'm saying. It's coming out of Texas. It's originating in Texas, but it is taking hold in certain quarters. So there is this pushback against this movement to really call it for what it is and to explore.
But there's always going to be a pushback.
No, there is always. But and this is where policy comes in. When you have policymakers saying, okay, whether it's institutional or structural, saying, okay, yeah, let's change the history books to put this in. That's when it becomes damaging. And we do have right. policymakers who are doing that.
And I think that's why this is it's called a struggle, you know, and why there is a struggle going on. And there's a new level to struggle in America that has not been around for a long time since the late 60s. It's taken place at this moment in this country. And I do believe we're in a very critical and important historical moment. Let me go to the phone to you. 410-319-8888. Let's see who's been holding on. Perret and then Melvin. Perret, you're on the air.
Sure. Thank you for the topic. So I want to make two quick comments. One, I'm hoping that we can begin to bring in a critique against the black leadership class or the black intelligentsia. Because if you take, for example, the militarization of these police departments, many of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus voted for it. If you take the 101 crack versus cocaine discrepancy, many of the black congressional members voted for it. And so there is this sort of increasing the vulnerabilities of the black community by way of our so-called leadership. And I know that when crisis happens, we don't want to point the finger at us. We want to keep the onus on white folk, and we should. But I also think we need to think about how our leadership is increasing our vulnerabilities. And last but not least, I would love to see if we can tie this conversation into the issue of segregation. In fact, our society is far more segregated today than it has ever been. And I'm wondering if this spatial distance continues to promote this cultural dissonance that white folk have for our community. And I'll take your response off the air.
I think that's a really important piece. I do want to get one caller in. We'll come right back so we can get two callers in. And if we have to bleed over a little bit in the second hour with our other guest, Danny, coming from Nation Magazine, we can do that because this will lead from this into misogyny. It's all connected to me, and we will link it all together. Our two guests are staying. And letting you all know that my producer just let me know that Lawrence Brown will be here on the show Wednesday at 10 o'clock. We're talking about our history and segregation in terms of Ferguson, Staten Island, and more, and how it relates to where we are today. So he is coming in on Wednesday. I'm glad to hear that. 410-319-8888. Melvin, you're on the air.
Yes. We continue to look at this issue from the end result. You know, it's always after an incident has happened, has occurred, someone's died. But the real problem is until we have economic justice, the police will automatically continue to assume that a black person or black man is doing something illegal because of the fact that they realize that we don't have access to education. The wages are well below what is good for the economy. So therefore, we'll continue to be looked at as criminals. So until we get the minimum wage to meet the DMP, which one senator had already talked about, until we actually get that in place, you can continue to have these types of incidents. And also, no one has mentioned the anesthesiologist that was the white anesthesiologist that was arrested for DUI. He spit blood on the cop, and he was released the next day with bail, went and set up practice again.
Right.
He was white, and so, you know.
So we're almost running out of time in this segment, so let me ask you to take one more sentence so we can come back to your thoughts.
All right. Thanks.
Okay, thank you so much, Bob. I mean, if you hang up, that's cool. So,
okay, in terms of the callers, and they all brought up some really great points, you know, there was this study done, and basically it showed that the average black person had 10 times the number of white friends than white people have black friends. So there is this disconnect. There is nothing to counter the cultural messages received by white people about African Americans. Whereas because African Americans have to live and exist in a majority white culture, understanding, knowing, relating, engaging with white people, that is just what we do. And the caller also brought up about the culpability of black leadership. I would bring up also the culpability of people getting involved in public policy, because we are responsible for the policymakers who serve us.
But doesn't mm-hmm. that kind of let them off the hook by saying
Nope, it doesn't let them off the hook. It is saying that there is enough responsibility and accountability that needs to go around. Politicians, policymakers need cover. And it is us, like when President Obama, when President Obama was elected the first time, what he said was, do not stop organizing, hold me accountable, right? Because we all know that deals are made, forces are all around, and that's just the environment in which people are dealing.
But when you elect people, Adar, and you, certain people are being elected on progressive principles,
mm-hmm.
and the only person the only person in the Maryland delegation to vote against the militarization of police was Don Edwards.
Right.
Everyone else voted for it.
Mark, I am not excusing it. It does not make it right. But what I'm saying is understanding that we continue to send the same politicians back.
That's true.
And that is on us. So I'm saying I loved what he said, but we need to broaden that conversation and really help people understand how policy impacts their day-to-day life.
So Adar is staying with us, which is a good thing. Adar Dyer is not going anywhere. I like it when she stays 2 hours. Doug Holbert is staying as well. We're going to take your callers, Charlene and Chris and Kenny. We are please do not hang up. You've been hanging on for a period of 2 to 5 minutes. Hang on another 2 minutes. We're going to come to all three of your calls. We come back after this break, and we're going to break with Out of Nowhere, Buck Clayton, Wilbur Dorsey Buck Clayton, the great jazz trumpeter, band leader, arranger, born on this day in Parsons, Kansas in 1911. We'll be right back.